Welcome to the show. I'm Jordan Harbinger. As always, I'm here with my producer, Jason DeFilippo. A few years back, I went to a private event with a lot of high-level entrepreneurs, and one man in particular stood out from the crowd in a few ways, one of which was a sense of calm focus that I don't often see in anyone, let alone the permanently frenetic entrepreneurs and creators that were the mainstay of the event. And when I engaged him in conversation, I quickly realized I was dealing with somebody who had a very sharp mind for business, but he'd been applying it to something that went horribly, horribly wrong in almost every way possible. Freeway Ricky Ross is one of the most well-known drug traffickers the world has ever seen. His drug empire in Los Angeles and beyond essentially kicked off the crack epidemic in the United States and elsewhere, for that matter. And I don't like to glorify anything like this, and we're going to get Rick's story from his own perspective. And trust me when I say this really is an incredible tale. A kid from the wrong side of the tracks ends up moving billions of dollars in cocaine and crack with help from a variety of characters, from the Nicaraguans to the Central Intelligence Agency. You cannot make this stuff up. But this episode isn't about selling drugs or organized crime. What follows is an extremely vulnerable and candid interview with a man whose personal potential and business acumen could have taken him to insane levels of success in any area, but the cannon was aimed tragically in the wrong direction. I really enjoyed sitting down with Ricky and recording this interview for you. I think there's a lot in this one, and we'll really get a feeling for what Rick means when he says that drugs become a crutch for the dealer as much as for the user. And I know what a lot of you are thinking. How does he run into these people? How does he meet and get opportunities with all these great guests? Well, I would love to share my systems and my tiny habits for maintaining and building networks and relationships with you. It is at advancedhumandynamics.com/level1. It's our level one course. It's free. advancedhumandynamics.com/level1. All right. Here's Freeway Rick. I was wondering, when you were inside, did you come out and then everyone's like, hey, check this out. And you're like, what? Like, why is everyone looking at this phone all the time?
Well, yeah, I was just telling her about my bus ride. You know, I left the prison at like 4 a.m. So when I get on the bus, everybody has cell phones. It's like, what is going on here? Everybody got phones?
Yeah. But you knew what they were from, like, television and stuff, right? But you didn't see, like, the apps.
I knew them from magazines.
Yeah.
Yeah, I knew from magazines. I was well-read. Not television. I didn't watch television at all.
No?
No, I didn't.
Did they not have that?
Or they had it. They had it. I just wasn't interested. I didn't have time.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
You were that busy in prison.
Yeah, in prison, I didn't have time. I was running out of time. I needed more time in the day. I used to say that people would think I'm crazy, you know, if I told them, you know what, I don't have enough time.
Yeah, because you hear about entrepreneurs be like, oh, there's not enough hours in the day, or like a mom, parents, there's not enough hours in the day. And it's like, but when you're in prison, it's like, maybe there's too many hours in the day.
Well, okay. You know, at first, before I learned how to work prison, how to make prison work for me, it was too much time in the day. You know, I was wishing that the day would go by. But as I started to expand my mind and my thoughts, it became not enough time in the day. You know, like, I need more time. I wish I had 2 or 3 more hours every day to finish some of the things that I'm trying to get accomplished.
What were you doing in the whole time? Writing the book. We just talked about that off mic.
Writing a book. I used to read movie scripts for a couple companies, you know, screening scripts for them, reading books, teaching other guys. The things that I had learned, I used to get about 75, 100 letters a week from people.
Really?
Asking for advice. So I was kind of like counseling from prison.
What were they asking about?
Just business, you know.
Business stuff?
For some reason, people, I don't know if you saw the one that the documentary BET did.
I saw the one on Netflix. Is that different?
Yeah, it's different.
Oh, man. I didn't know.
BET did one called American Gangsters. It was a series that they did. Matter of fact, you know, we hold a record right now for the all-time watch show on BET. And more people watch the American Gangster series than any other show ever, even the awards. Even though BET don't let me come to the awards.
They don't?
No, they don't let me come. I don't know why. Well, yes, I do. They got the rapper, so.
Oh, so there's that whole beef. And I'll ask about that later, but they were like, oh, well.
We'll take the fake over the real.
We can only have one Ricky Ross. So we got a quota.
Well, you know, it's a thing about society, and it's really strange how it works, right? They'll kind of shine on a real drug dealer, but they allow people who pretend to be drug dealers to come everywhere and go everywhere and participate in everything. But the real guys who really did it, who, even though now you're saying, hey, selling drugs is bad, don't do it, yeah, you're not going to win. It looks like it's fun, but, you know, in the end, it's a lot of hardship that goes with it. You know, they won't allow you to do the same things that they'll let the guys go on there and brag about. Oh, I sold 300 kilos. I'm the man, homie. Miami AO. And they embrace these guys and pay them $75,000, $80,000 to come to their schools and do songs for their kids. And then they wonder why their kids want to be drug dealers.
Yeah, it's crazy. That is crazy. I was going to get to that later, but I'll do it now. I'm curious what you think about that, because, of course, you've got this guy who people go, oh, the rapper? You're interviewing the rapper? And I was like, no, he took the guy's name and he's using it because he was in prison and he thought, I don't know why. I mean, how did that even happen? How did that even come about?
Well, the guy was smart, you know, as a businessman, you know, no different than some of the other companies that have stolen property from somebody, you know, and found a loophole where it wasn't properly trademarked or copywritten or was in domain, you know, was just sitting there and wasn't being used. Well, he saw my name in that position and my reputation being in that same position. And what he did is he capitalized on it. He grabbed it. He made it his own. He went and trademarked it, took it to Universal and Warner Brothers and sold it to them. And they bought it. And that's pretty much how it all came about, that him stealing my name and so forth.
Yeah, it's so strange. Wasn't he like a prison guard before?
He was.
So he's rapping about things he's probably never done.
Never.
Like sell drugs, running from the police, all that stuff.
Well, you know, if you ran from the police, I don't think they would let you be a prison guard.
Maybe not. Yeah. Although, who knows? I don't know.
And let alone some of the other things that he talked about, you know, selling 300 kilos. And then if you look at his record, you can see that it was no way possible that he could have accomplished the things that he said he accomplished in those terms. But, you know, I mean, in society right now, you can pretty much write yourself in any way you want to be.
Yeah.
You know,
it's not
about being documented anymore.
You know, Instagram, you can just pretend and then it becomes real.
Yeah. If enough people believe it, you know, you get enough people who don't study, who don't pay attention, you know.
Yeah.
And they'll buy into it. I mean, even the fact what really, you know, we sued him too.
Yeah.
I lost though.
Right. I know. I saw that.
Yeah. The judge was like, well, you should have filed your lawsuit 5 days before you got out of prison. But doing that, we even looked him up. You know, we started researching him. You know, we wanted to know, who is this guy? Where did he come from? Why doesn't he have his own history?
Yeah.
And then they said that he played football. And we looked up and we're like, how could this guy play football? And there's not one picture of him with a football uniform on anywhere. You can't find it. So we called a coach at the high school who coached during the time, and coach didn't know his name. And so we were like, how could this guy be an All-American football player and had never took a picture with his uniform on? And so, you know, at the end of the day, what he did is, you know, he wrote a story about his life and people bid it. So that's it.
Yeah. You think he would be like, all right, how about the real Rick Ross, front row seats every concert? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you know what? When I was in prison, I talked to him a couple of times and I had some great ideas for me and him to do some things together that I thought would have enhanced his career as well as mine. Even one time, you know, I was telling him, at your next concert, you should let me call in.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you call from prison, it has a thing that says, this is a call from a correctional institution.
Right.
If you accept this call, dial 5. This call is from Ricky Ross. And I thought that if he would have done that and let his fans hear us talk, would have enhanced his
street cred.
Yeah. Because the guys who are really from the streets, they know. You know, we have a lot of kids who play like they're from the streets.
Mm-hmm.
But the guys who are really from the streets, they really know what's going on. So I thought that would have enhanced his career. And, you know, I mean, he could have just basically gave me a job, you know, like when yeah. I got out of prison, you yeah. know, I got out in 09, when the economy was crashed, it was really bad. And I had a hard time, you know, getting on my feet.
Sure.
You know, a lot of people, you know, Floyd Mayweather picked me up from the halfway house, and that's something that he should have did. You know, he should have been the one who picked me up and, you know, gave me an opportunity.
Why did Floyd Mayweather pick you up from the halfway house?
Well, you know,
and how long were you inside?
I did 20 years.
Well, yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah.
Well, you know, Floyd and the rapper was beefing.
Yeah.
And apparently that was a way for Floyd to get back at the rapper.
Sure.
To pick me up, take pictures with me and video it and so forth.
And be like, the real Ricky Ross.
Yeah.
Sucker.
Yeah. 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 And I didn't know at the time. I thought that was going to be an opportunity for me to get set up. You know, I didn't know that that was only a way for him to get back at the rapper. Because yeah. if it would have been, I wouldn't have participated. You sure. know, I don't have time for games.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a grown man and my time is limited. And I have to use my time to the best of my ability.
Yeah, of course. Of course. I want to back up and start from when you were younger as well. You grew up, you lived in, tell me about the neighborhood where you grew up and what was going on.
South Central Los yeah. Angeles.
Yeah. I think everybody's heard about that. Whether they heard about it from living there or watching the news or playing video games. So you heard of South Central.
Yeah.
LA.
Yeah. Well, most people played the game. What is it called? Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
And you know, when I was in prison, it's funny. You know, DJ Pooh wrote that. And he grew up looking up to me. And when I was in prison, and I was in prison. I didn't know DJ Pooh had wrote Grand Theft Auto. And this kid from Iowa sent me a letter and some of the transcripts from the thing. And he was saying, this guy, Big Smokey, is you. I'm telling you, mm-hmm. this guy is you. And I started reading the transcripts. I was like, wow, this is related.
Yeah.
So a lot of people probably heard about South Central from watching the playing the games and you know, watching Friday and a few other
Friday.
TV shows.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I grew up there. I mean, you know, we thought South Central was normal. You know, when I was first coming up, I wanted to be a gang member. You know,
really?
When I was about 9 or 10 years old, you know, I thought about being a Crip, you know, I thought being in a Crip would be cool, but I got lucky. You know, my mom was really strict, you know, at that time.
You didn't
was.
Feel lucky at the time, though.
No, I didn't. I felt deprived.
Sure. Like all the other kids are Crips. Why can't I be a Crip?
But by the time I got into 12th grade, I mean, 12 years old, I was introduced to tennis and I fell in love with tennis. Played tennis up until high school. Thought I would be going to college to play, but I never learned how to read or write. So, that squashed the opportunity of me going to college and playing college tennis. So I found myself back in South Central LA, but now I'm a grown man. I'm 18 years old. I make my own decisions. My mom don't tell me what to do no more. I'm pretty much doing whatever I want to do. And I find myself in a place of not knowing what I'm going to do with the rest of my life.
So you started playing tennis. You're looking up to guys like Arthur Ashe.
That was my man. I loved Arthur Ashe. He came down to our school one year and gave out trophies and hit with a couple of guys on the team. And that was like, wow.
It was surprising to me to hear that you loved tennis, because when you think of tennis, you think of like white guys with these little like shorts on, the socks are pulled up and they're hitting the ball back and forth. And you think recently now you got Serena Williams and Venus Williams and things like that. But you don't think there's kids in South Central LA being like, man, that's really
cool.
No,
it wasn't. And it was strange how we even started, you know, we were on the tennis court playing roller derby, and this guy comes up and he's like, bet you boys can't hit that ball in the box. And that's how it started. And, you know, a couple of us fell in love with it immediately. And then, gradually, more of us started to, gravitate to it.
And then you started playing for school and then.
Yeah. Started playing for Dorsey High School.
So how come you didn't end up going on a college scholarship to play tennis? Because they
couldn't read or write.
Even though you went to school the whole time, you couldn't read or write.
Yeah.
How did you get by not knowing how to read or write the whole time?
Well, by me being on the tennis team, my coach would always go to the teachers and get them to give me a passing grade so I would be eligible for the team. And I guess in a lot of ways, too, you know, I found out that I had developed a sense of how to make people like me.
Sure. Yeah.
And my teachers probably liked me.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Didn't want to hurt me.
Sure.
And felt that passing me on would be the right thing to do, because if they didn't pass me, then I would have been stuck probably in the ninth grade.
Yeah. Or maybe they really didn't like you and they're like, I don't want this kid in my class anymore. I'm going to get him out of here. Pass.
Well, you know, I didn't really cause trouble in class. You know, I wasn't the type. I would tell jokes once in a while,
sure,
but I wasn't the kind that would disrupt the class. I knew better than to disrupt the class. It would be better to go in the back of the class, put your head down and go to sleep and wait, you know, till recess or till the bell rung to the next class or go to the tennis court. So, I wasn't disruptive in the class. And I think that that helped as well.
You're listening to the Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Freeway Rick Ross. We'll be right back after these important messages.
This episode is sponsored in part by HostGator. All right, when was the last time you thought about your online presence, right? Sure, you have a Facebook account and a Twitter account that you never use and an Instagram account that you use way too much. But maybe you had a MySpace account when it was all the rage and everything you did now there is gone. So what are you going to do when what you're sharing today with the masses decides to move on to the next big thing? You can't control the social media landscape, but you can control your own website. HostGator, around since 2002, can set you up with one today. You don't even need to know a thing about coding. HostGator is going to take care of the technical details, leave you to make your mark online as you see fit, whether you've got your own business or you're just trying to run a hobby site. We recommend HostGator's website builder. They allow you to choose from over 100 mobile-friendly templates, so your site's going to look good on the phone, the iPad, the desktop. You want to use WordPress? One click. Add-on options like SEO, PayPal integration so you can accept payments. Also, 99.9% guaranteed uptime. Their support team is there to help. Any issues, 24/7, 365. And it's not going to break the bank. HostGator is giving our wonderful listeners up to 62% off all packages for new users with a 45-day complete money-back guarantee. And you get unlimited email addresses based from your website that you can hand out in place of that free Gmail address you've been using for ages. It can finally be your name at yourdomain.com. It looks much more professional, signals a lot more professionalism. Go to HostGator.com/Jordan right now to sign up. That's HostGator.com/Jordan. This episode is sponsored in part by DesignCrowd. Crowdsourcing is how busy people get stuff done in the 21st century. And thanks to DesignCrowd, you can focus on running your business while handing over the reins for your company's logo, web design, t-shirt, you name it, to a pool of over 600,000 professional designers around the world. And DesignCrowd crowdsources custom work based on your specs, so you pick the design you like best. Here's how it works. Visit designcrowd.com/Jordan. You tell them what you need in a little brief. They invite just over 500,000 designers from Sydney to San Francisco to respond. Within hours, you start getting designs. And over the course of 3 to 10 days, you can receive 60 to 100. I think I got like 600 different designs from designers around the world in just over a week. You really cannot beat that. You pick the design you like best. You approve payment to the designer, and in the unlikely event you don't like any of the submitted designs, well, you're indecisive just like me. Congratulations, you're in good company, and DesignCrowd offers a money-back guarantee. So tell them how they can get a hold of that, Jason.
Check out designcrowd.com/Jordan. That's DesignCrowd.com/Jordan for a special $100 VIP offer for our listeners, or simply enter the discount code Jordan when posting a project on DesignCrowd. Thanks for listening and supporting the show. Your support of our advertisers is what keeps us on the air. To learn more and get links to all the great discounts you just heard, visit jordanharbinger.com/deals. And don't forget, we have a worksheet for today's episode so you can make sure you solidify your understanding of the key takeaways from Freeway Ricky Ross. That link is in the show notes at jordanharbinger.com/podcast. And now for more from Freeway Ricky Ross.
How did you then get into, you went from, all right, I'm playing tennis. All right, I can't go to college because I can't read or write. Take us from there to, I'm going to start selling drugs. Or how did you start getting into that business from then?
Well, I started hanging out with my younger brothers and some of the homies that I grew up with in junior high school and high school. I mean, not high school, because I went to Dorsey High School, which was quite a ways away from where I lived. But I went to junior high school in South Central, Bret Hart Junior High School. So I started hanging out with them. And when I started hanging out with them, I started doing the things that they were doing. They were driving 66 Chevys, 65 Chevys, and they wanted to be lowriders. So I started riding in the car with them, and then they had what they call the street hops. And one day they take me up here to the street hops, and I see these cars with these pretty paint jobs. And
street hops like a party with your car?
Yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
In a parking lot, and everybody's playing their music. And I was like, wow, I want one of those cars. They got the girls and, you know, convertibles, and the girls hanging out the top, sitting on the seats, and the cars going up and down. And I'm like, oh, man, this is the life. I don't know what I've been doing. I've been wasting my time on that tennis court, chasing them balls, getting nothing out of it, no girlfriend. Mm-hmm. I'm with these cars. So I started going around asking the guys, how did they get the cars? So when I first started asking, you know, most of the guys were car thieves.
So they just stole the car.
They just stole cars. So I started hanging out with them. I started driving cars for them. I would drive stolen cars. They'd give me $50. I bought my first Chevy for $100.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Convertible 66.
I assume that was also a stolen car, probably.
No, it wasn't stolen. No, back then you could get a car for $100.
What?
A 66 convertible. Something probably worth like $70,000 right now.
Sure.
So I just started driving for them. And next thing you know, I learned how to take all the parts off the car. I'm stripping them down. And
chop shop. That's what my mom used to say. Is that what they call that?
Yep, that's what they call it. And eventually I had my own chop shop at like 18 years old. Eventually it got raided by the cops.
Sure.
Went to jail. And I'm back in no man's land again. I don't know what I'm going to do. I thought, you know, stealing cars was going to be my life career.
How long were you in jail? Because you were what, 18?
Just a couple, like a day and a half. My mom bailed me right out.
Oh, man. She must have been pissed if she was strict and she found out you were chopping up cars.
She was, but I was grown, so she couldn't tell me much then. You know?
Why did she bail you out? Do you think she should have left you in there?
Well, you know how moms is. Moms are going, you know, you can be the worst kid in the world and you're still mama's baby. You know, she's still going to back you, you know, no matter what happened. Your mom, you know, I mean, if you stop your mom from loving you, you've been messing up real bad.
Yeah.
And you know, I wasn't messing up that bad to where, you know, I would never disrespect my mom. Never. I wouldn't listen to her.
Yeah.
You know, I might say, oh, all right, mom. And as she said, go in one ear and out the other. But as far as talking back to her or something like that, I would never do that. So she had my back, you know. So she bailed me out, put her house up, and I'm back on the streets. But now I'm back on the streets without a hustle. So I'm sitting on the porch and I don't know what I'm gonna do. And my partner calls me and he's like, man, I got the new thing. And it was cocaine.
And cocaine at that point, was that for rich old white dudes? Like it was.
Cocaine was really, really expensive then.
Yeah.
You know, a gram of cocaine back then, what we were buying was called eighths. And it was 3 grams of cocaine, supposedly. Mm-hmm. But what I found out is that they were taking a gram of cocaine and they would put 2 grams of cut on it.
What do they cut it with?
McKnight.
What is it?
McKnight.
What's that?
It's some substance. I don't know. You bought it from liquor stores. Liquor stores sold it. It was powdery, you know, like it was powdery. It looked like cocaine kind of. But later on, I found out how to tell the difference, you know. So we were paying like $375 for that. So technically, a gram of cocaine at that time was like $375.
Wow. What year was this?
Like 79, 80.
And now a gram of cocaine is what, like $80 or something like that? I don't even know.
No, probably like $10.
$10? Yeah. So it was dozens of times more expensive back then than it is now.
Like 300 times.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, because adjusted for inflation and everything. I don't really know how to do that math on the fly. Sorry, everybody, but it's a lot. Yeah.
Well, we saw the price go down dramatically. When I started, my first kilo that I ever bought, I paid $45,000 for it. And when I stopped selling, I was getting keys for like $9,500.
So your business, and I have this in my notes for later, that disrupted the market to the point where the price dropped like 80-85%.
Correct.
Because of the volume.
Right. And that's what I wanted to do. I mean, my plan was when I first found out about cocaine, I felt that it was something that rich white people did.
Yeah.
And they didn't let blacks do it. And I had been through black and white situations.
It's just like tennis, damn it. Right.
Well, you know, my mom was from the South. You know, we moved from the South when I was like 3, but we used to go back to Texas all the time. So one time and I mentioned this in my book in more graphic detail, but my mom took me to a doctor because I fell off the truck.
You fell off a truck?
Yeah, I fell off a truck. And I was all skin up. So she takes me to the doctor and we walk in the doctor's office and they had this big, pretty TV sitting on the wall. And I walk up. It has a sign on it too, but I can't read. And I walk up and I turn the TV on and this nurse that's like goes off on me. You can't touch that TV. And at that time we were in the front office, you know, something nice like this here. But then they told us, oh, you guys got to go to the back. So we go to the back. And in the back, it's like dirty, filthy cigarette butts, cups, you know, like stuff on the wall. And that was the black section. So
in the South, in the 60s, 70s.
Yeah, probably like 67 ish, something like that. Maybe 68, you know.
OK, so it was like segregated, basically.
It was still segregated. Yeah, a lot. I mean, Texas. Well, you know, Texas was the last place to abolish slavery anyway.
I did not know that.
Yeah, Juneteenth. They celebrated in Texas the day that they won their freedom, even though they were late to the party. But it's celebrated heavily in Texas, Juneteenth, the day that they found out that they was no longer slaves. So, yeah, I had been through that. So when I saw cocaine, I felt that cocaine was on those same lines, was something that white people had and they didn't want blacks to have it.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. So that interests you. You were like, well, all right, if I can't have this, then I'm going to take it anyway. I want to do it.
I want
That makes me want to do it more. Typical teenager in a lot of ways.
And you know, I saw the movie Superfly. I don't know if you ever saw Superfly.
Yeah, sure, a long time ago.
Yeah, well, I saw how Superfly did it, and he beat the man, you know. Told the man, you can do my dirty laundry. That ain't going to help you. So I felt all of those things. And you're talking about a 19-year-old kid, you know, who's never read a book, who didn't have a father, you know, nobody to really guide him through, teach him the ropes of entrepreneurship. But I had that entrepreneur blood in me, you know.
Yeah.
I used to do car washes. I picked up cans. I hustled bottles from my neighbors, grass. I mean, you name it, I done hustled it. So I know that I had that entrepreneur fever, but I didn't have a way to channel it. So when cocaine came along, that was my way of channeling my energy.
And who was the customer that time? Rich white dudes with office jobs?
No, my customers start off wealthy blacks.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, because I didn't know any white people at that time. I think we had one white friend, Doherty, because one of my friends had got bused to Van Nuys High School, and he used to bring Doherty back to L.A. with him. You know, Doherty, and it was crazy. And the police would see Doherty hanging out with us, and they would pull over and jack us all up and ask Doherty, are you all right? What you doing over here hanging out with these guys?
Man. Oh, my God.
But he was the only white friend that we had. So my first customer was a pimp. My very first customer was a pimp. It went from pimps to the prostitutes. Only the people who had money, you know, you had to have money. And then it went from them to Todd Shipyard, to the postman.
The mailman?
Yeah, the mailman.
He had money?
A mail job in South Central. That's a great job.
I didn't know that.
To be a mailman? Oh, yeah. They kill over that. These people would kill you if they can get a job at the post office.
How times have changed. Yeah, wow. And so how did the cocaine then turn into the crack? Like what's going on?
Well,
there?
Well, when I first started, everybody cooked their own drugs for themselves.
What do you mean? Like, what does that mean?
Well, they would buy the powder from me, and then they would cook it up, turn it into rocks. What we call rock, we didn't call it crack. We call it rock.
Rock. Okay.
Yeah, the government called it crack.
Gotcha.
All right. That's the government's name.
That's from Channel 7 Action News. Yeah.
We called it Ready Rock, and what happened is that people would come by early in the mornings. You know, 7, 6 in the morning on their way to work, and they'd be like, man, I need some. And they'd be like, I ain't got the utensils. And so I started off just cooking it for them so it would be ready for them.
What's the point of cooking it? Like, you know, a lot of people who know, everyone knows that you do cocaine, you put it on the table and you shove it up your nose. Why do you need to cook it into rocks? What's the benefit?
Well, the part you're doing in the nose, you can snort to make night, to cut. But with smokers, with freebasers, they don't want to taste the McKnight.
Oh, okay.
They want the McKnight to be gone. They want to taste pure cocaine. So what they do is they cook it, and it boils all the impurities off of it. You know, you take it and you turn it to gel, and it turns to a gel. And then when it cools off, that gel turns into like a little rocky substance. And that for the impurity, they want it to be just this one flavor.
And so then, and then they smoke it.
Correct. They put it on a pipe, put it in cigarettes.
Before work. That seems like a, I'm drinking coffee over here thinking that would be a little bit too much at 7 a.m.
Well, you know what? You know, cocaine is an upper.
Yeah.
So it's going to make you, for a while, it's going to make you like go faster and better. I mean, you know, when I first started, it was, you know, we thought it was like a party drug.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something that you, when you got ready to party, you did. So why not go to work and have a party? You know, while you're at work. I mean, what better way to be at work when you're having fun?
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't work a job that I'm not having fun.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people are like that. I think a lot of them are like, maybe I don't want to have to smoke crack, though, to make my job fun. Maybe that's an indicator that you should get another job.
I agree.
So, all right. So you decided, like, look, all right, if you don't have the utensils, I'll just cook it, what, at my house, and then I'll have it ready for you?
Yeah, I have it ready for you. We started calling it Ready Rock. We got a Ready Rock.
Yeah.
You know, we'd have the powder and the rock.
It's like instant oatmeal.
Yes.
It's Ready Rock. All right.
And then eventually, the rock cocaine took over the powder. They didn't want powder anymore. Nobody asked for powder. So everybody stopped selling powder. Everybody in L.A. started selling rock. And it just like really, it really made the business easier because now you could be standing on the block and you could have an ounce of cocaine on a rock and then you just chip it off until the person was satisfied with what he was getting.
Wow. And you had to weigh it though, right? Or were you just eyeballing it?
You could eyeball it. We used to eyeball it. You know, sometimes I wanted to get a little more, sometimes you get a little less. But, you know, once you do it so much, you get really, really good at it.
How long were you cooking and selling cocaine then the first go round? How did you scale your business up? How long was this going on? Because I assume you started with like in an apartment with a buddy or whatever, small time.
Yep, $125 a piece we started with. Took a few months, you know. Well, basically what I did is I pulled all the money back into the business. You know, every time we made $50-100, I put it back in. I went and bought more drugs until we got our first ounce.
How long did that take?
That was hard. Getting to your first ounce was really hard because we went through a lot of trials and tribulations, you know, giving stuff out on credit.
Mm-hmm.
When I first started, I didn't know that you don't let somebody who smoked cocaine hold your cocaine for you.
Oh, yeah, probably not. Like, oh, so what happened was you gave me a bag and I was holding it and then I decided to have a little.
But I got all your money. Let me tell you where it's at. I gave such and such credit. I gave him credit. And you know, they would give credit because if they give him credit, they're going to get him a hit.
Yeah.
So I gave him credit. He owes you $50. He owes you $100. And now your whole $2,800 is accounted for.
Oh, man. So you had to go and try to collect that and nobody had it, I see.
Yeah, nobody had it. Then they're not going to pay. They go somewhere else.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was one of my first lessons, you know, that you don't let anybody smoke hold your bag.
Yeah, so that's where never get high on your own supply came from, probably.
Yeah. Yeah, so we went through that, and I'd say about 2 months, you know, I was buying 2 ounces, then 4 ounces, and then a pound, and then 10 pounds, and it just kept growing and growing.
And where are you getting 10 pounds of cocaine from?
Well, we start off with Mike, the guy who first introduced me. That's who we start off with. We wasn't buying pounds from him. We was buying sevenths and half ounces. But after I started rolling, I had a teacher that I used to hang out with, Mr. Fisher. And when I started selling cocaine, I stopped hanging out with him. We stopped playing tennis. And one day I just went by to see him. I was doing pretty good. You know, at that time I probably had about $40,000-$50,000.
Where'd you keep your money?
In shoeboxes
in the house?
At my mom's house, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. Well, my mom had put me out, so I didn't live with my mom anymore. I was staying with a cousin, but I still kept my money at my mom's house because I felt it would be safe there.
Sure. Yeah.
She would allow me to come in and out the house. She just didn't want me to stay there.
And you're just like, just putting in a pair of shoes under the bed. No problem. Just another pair of shoes.
Yeah, so when I told him what I was doing, he told me to come by his house, and then when I got there, he explained to me that he used to sell cocaine too.
The tennis coach.
Not the tennis coach, the teacher, yeah. And that he didn't get all the things that he had from being a teacher. Like, this house didn't come from being no teacher. That Cadillac, no.
Because you're like, I should just become a teacher. This looks like a pretty sweet gig. Wait a minute.
This jewelry I got on, no.
So he was moonlighting or he was done selling cocaine?
He wasn't selling cocaine at that time.
Okay.
He had started to be a user. And I believe that's probably why he wasn't in the business anymore. He ran himself out of business from using up his product.
Oh, and then he went, can't reload. Yeah. It's going to end badly. So he just became a teacher?
Yeah.
That's interesting. All right. Interesting career shift.
Yeah. So he introduced me to the first Nicaraguans that I met.
And Nicaraguans. Okay. Yeah. That seems, because looking at that now, that's a strange connection. I probably know two people from Nicaragua. They're not just walking around all over the place. Like, you can meet a Mexican person in L.A. real easy, El Salvador, no problem. It just seems like when you meet somebody from a country like that that's going through this, has a dictator going through that transition, the ominous music, it starts to play in the background, right, of the story at this point.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I didn't know what Nicaraguans were.
Sure.
I didn't know about the war. I mean, you know, I'm just a young, dumb kid from South Central L.A. who's trying to make it.
Sure.
Who's trying to help his mom get out of her situation with her house and fix the house up. And I had younger brothers and sisters who I was worried about, you know.
Yeah.
And I just took it on myself to make sure that they was okay, that they ate.
So you meet this Nicaraguan guy, and from your teacher, and he's like, hey, I can get you a lot more of this or what? I mean, how did that start?
No, he just said that he had a connection for me.
Okay.
And I was like, wow, a connection. Yeah, I ain't got to go through Mike no more with all of his BS and waiting. And so when the guys came over, we looked at the stuff and it was the best cocaine we ever seen.
What made it better?
It was like already in little rocks, you know, chunky.
Bricks
little
of cocaine, yeah.
Yes.
What does a kilo look like?
Straight off the brick.
Is it really like a brick like you see in the movies?
Yeah, it kind of looks like this book right here, probably about the size of this book, and uses like two slabs. Sometimes it'd be one slab this size. Sometimes it's round.
So know? It's almost like 8.5 by 11, maybe a little bit smaller. I don't know what the dimensions of that book are.
Yeah. And sometimes they had some that would make it round, and sometimes it'd be wrapped in Rolex tape. Just different, you know, different techniques that they use to smuggle it over.
So you're picking up this thing for $45,000 that can fit pretty much in your hand.
Yes.
And you must be thinking, what were you thinking? Like, if I held something like that, I think
the police would never catch me with this.
It's just the duct tape covered or plastic wrap covered brick of white powder, which most people probably hadn't even seen at that point in their life.
Yeah, because
it wasn't in the movies and stuff back then.
No,
it?
Not like that. No,
no.
I never saw it like that before in the movies. No.
And it's also the most expensive thing that you can fit in your hand that costs that much money, probably. Maybe
yeah,
a watch.
Yeah, absolutely. At that time, they say cocaine was more expensive than gold.
Yeah, I believe that. Yeah.
Because an ounce, you figure at that time, an ounce of cocaine. Now, I was buying a kilo for 45, but sure. If I was buying ounces, they were probably like $3,200 an ounce. So if you do that times 36, a kilo probably would, you know, when you break it down, I probably was making about $55,000 off of a kilo.
Off of 1 kilo. And how long did it take to distribute that kilo?
At different times. It would start off, when I first started, it might take a week, you know, and then it would go to 2 days. And
wow.
And then 1 day, and then 2 kilos a day, and then 10 kilos a day. And it just, you know, just kept escalating and escalating and escalating.
How much money are we talking about here when you're going through 2 kilos a day? What is your gross, and like, what are you netting from that? Like, what's the total that you're spending on that, and what's your profit on that?
I'm spending about $85,000-$90,000, you know, for 2 kilos
in
1 day. And I'm probably going to make close to 100 profit.
And that's a lot of shoeboxes to keep the money in. So at some point, there's shoebox
money. Oh, yeah, the shoebox was overran. I got a safe put in my mom's house. And it was overran as well.
Yeah, sure. I mean, unless you can walk into that safe, you can't fill it up.
The first time, when you read the book, you know, I bought your book. So
yeah, I appreciate that.
You get to read the book.
I will.
And you'll see the first time that my mom found out I've been stashing money in her house. I had a pile of money up under dirty clothes because the shoeboxes wouldn't work anymore. So I had a big pile of dirty clothes, and I would pile it up and put my money up under there. And I come back and my mom is sitting on the couch. And I'm looking.
She's like, one, your clothes are clean. And two, where did all this money come from?
It was $100,000.
And, yeah.
And I had never counted all my money at one time. So.
But she counted it?
Yeah. She counted.
Wow.
Started crying.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Begging me to get out. Get out now. Can you get out? You know, because she believed that the mafia controlled it. And that, you know, once you get in the mob, you can't get out. You know, she was kind of like the old TV stuff, sure. You know. But I was like, Mom, I'm the mob.
Yeah, yeah. What did she think about that?
I didn't tell her that.
Okay. I was like, that would not be a good reaction.
No, I didn't tell my mom.
Awkward
that.
Things.
But that's how I felt, though. I was like, Mom, I'm the mob. What is she talking about?
Yeah.
I run this whole area over here is all mine. This is my territory.
Who were the other people that had other territory around you at this point?
At that time, man, it was kind of like I had to run the land at that time. You know, later on, people started, you know, the Colombians started coming in.
Sure.
Directly to South Central LA. But at that time, it was all me. You know, I could set the prices and it was crazy.
So this is a new drug. There's nothing like it. How much cocaine? 2 kilos a day. So, I mean, that's a lot of.
Like 200,000.
Yeah.
Would go through my hands that day.
That's crazy. You must have been worried about security at that point.
No, nobody knew me.
Nobody knew you?
Nope.
Even though you had that much money going through?
I did, but, you know, at that time it wasn't cameras on everybody's phone. Right. And so they wasn't taking pictures and show your picture around. So really the only people who knew that I was a drug dealer was people who actually were selling drugs with me.
You sure. Know?
And,
yeah.
And I discovered the low-keyness, you know, don't dress like a drug dealer. You know, don't look like a drug dealer. Don't drive cars that drug dealers drive. So I didn't fit that stereotype. So people really didn't know what I looked like. They just knew the myth.
So they expected you in like a big Cadillac with fancy rims or something.
Yeah, like everybody was was driving Cadillac with the white wall tires with the gold leaf through them, the Vogue tires, and they had the big suit. And I wanted it one time. I wanted the Superfly car, you know, after I walked out the theater and saw Superfly. But then I started to think about it, and I was like, what's the best move to make? Should you be Superfly, or should you be discreet and get the money?
Yeah.
So I said that I wanted the money.
So what did you drive instead?
Anything. Buckets, Novas, Buicks, Volkswagens. Anything that I felt was inconspicuous. Mm-hmm. And I kind of had learned from stealing cars, you know, how to avoid the police and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
They kind of taught me how to do that, what the police look for and things like. If I was driving my lowrider, they always pull my lowrider over.
Sure.
You know, I'm coming down with the car bouncing up and down in the wheels. And so I would never drive that during a drug deal. That would only be on the weekends.
Yeah. So you took the weekends off?
Nope.
No, I was all right. So that makes sense.
I make too much money to take days off.
Yeah.
How can you take off and you're making that kind of money?
If you're making $100,000 profit a day, I don't know if I would at least work half days. I would definitely, I don't think I could just be like, don't call me on the weekend.
I took very, very few days off. Yeah. I mean, I fell in love with my job. You know, it's like, everything goes better with Coke. You know, that's how I felt. So,
is that a slogan from Coca-Cola that you just adopted? that I haven't heard from the 70s. Oh, man. Yeah.
So I took very few days off. I mean, I felt, you know, when I was sitting in prison and I was looking back at my life, I was almost like an addict. You know, it's like, I got to have it every single day. Every day I got to get my fix.
The business fix.
Yes.
Yeah. Because you didn't do the drug, did you?
I did it for a short time, like a couple, maybe a week, week and a half, and made me sick.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Just like allergic to it or something or what?
No, just having too much of it to do and never doing drugs, you know, never drinking alcohol, never smoking weed, no cigarettes. And then to go from zero to 60.
Crack. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like you went real fast.
That escalates quickly. So how did your organization look? How many people were working with you and like how many people are underneath you and working on this?
We started with just me and Ali, you know, that was my partner. And then we hired our first employee was Johnny Mumbles.
Johnny Mumbles?
Yeah, one of the homies from the hood who, you know, he started wanting to get out before everybody else. And then eventually it went to the whole clique, you know, everybody that we hung out with, our little group. We wasn't a gang, but we were a group of guys that stuck together. You know, we stayed in our little pocket. And we would rival whoever, you know, if somebody came into our neighborhood and wanted to do something to one of us, then, you know, we would deal with it. So we had our little clique. So went from there, probably like 40, 50 of us, and that became my crew.
And who's distributing this? Because if you're making that much money, that's a lot of people buying $10, $20, $50 bags.
Well, everybody was distributing. I mean, we had
everybody.
We had multiple houses, multiple streets. And then, you know, people start coming from out of town, you know, from different cities, Detroit, Chicago, Atlanta, you know, Cincinnati. They just started coming, you know, they started hearing about it. And, you know, people wanted to come to L.A. and get their fix, mm-hmm. you know, get their price, and they would take it back to their cities and sell it.
A lot of people are thinking, all right, you know, you're making, I think you made up around $1 billion in the 80s in L.A. That's what I heard on the documentary. Does that sound right?
I don't know. You know, the prosecutor said for 2 years, I made like $600 million, he said. Not profit for me, but money that went through my hands. Mm-hmm. But you figure that was only 2 years. And before I started making $1 million every day, we was making $500 every day. Before we was making $500, we made $400. Before we was making $4, we made $2. Before he was making $2, he made $100.
So you scaled up to $1 million a day.
Yeah, yeah. I had days that I went through $3 million in one day.
How are you even counting that much money?
Oh, you have money counters.
Yeah.
And you have a team of girls that sit there and they count money all day. You know, you have a house and this house would have like a slot in the door and people would just come in and drop duffel bags through the door.
So the distributor, I don't know, what is it, like a regional manager, some type guy, comes in with a duffel bag full of money, drops it through the slot in the door?
Well, that was customers. They wasn't really managers. They was customers.
Okay. But not individual users for the duffel bag full of money. Because if you're buying a duffel bag full of cash worth of drugs, you're not using it yourself.
No. These guys are not using it. Yeah. Everybody had started to get hip at that time not to use. And I really preach not to use. You know, I used to tell everybody, don't use. You should be a seller.
It's like a multi-level marketing. Don't use the product. Just sell the product to other people who sell the product.
And eventually, you know, guys started to catch on, you know, and stopped using and started to sell it.
Why'd you hire women? You said you have a group of girls counting the money. Why'd you hire girls to do it?
Well, it was a guy that didn't use. He wouldn't be sitting in the house counting money all day. You know, he's going to be out making money. You know, most women, they don't look at it the same. I mean, even though there was a few women who really got money, you know, doing it, but most of them didn't. And I just feel more comfortable. And the women that I use, I grew up with them. They was like my homegirls, so I trusted them too, mm-hmm. you know, because it had to be a lot of trust, even though they every now and then would get heavy handed too.
yeah. Like, hey, where'd you get that nice new
Cadillac?
Yeah. And why am I missing $60,000?
No, but you know what they started doing? Because I told the guys, I said, I don't take ones anymore. So I told the guys, if you bring ones, I don't count them. And so they kept bringing me ones, you know, like $30,000, $40,000 in one day on $1 bills. So the girls were like, oh, well, Rick don't count the ones to them anyway, so they started taking the ones.
So they're like, I need this duffel bag real quick to bring 80,000 $1 bills back home and stash in my basement. You didn't want to count the ones because it was a waste of your time.
And it was too many. You know, the connections didn't want them. It was too bulky. And it was just a headache. You know,
it's like pennies now.
Right.
I can't buy anything.
I'd have $1 bills stacked up. I mean, one time we had a closet that was like 3 or 4 feet high with $1 bills, you know, just $1 bills just piled up, you know, and it was like, what are we going to do with them? You know, the police going to come and take them, you know, it's just.
Yeah, it's like, a liability.
It was a liability. So we didn't want it once.
So you basically were able to pay the women a tip in all of those ones, or they just took it?
Well, we paid everything in one. We bought gas in ones. I mean, we go out and eat in $1 bills. You know, we'd be at a restaurant paying at one.
Oh my God.
And they'd probably be looking at us crazy. But we had to get rid of them. You know, it was just like, it was a burden moving them around. Yeah. We had them in garages. I know somebody found out we had like 60, 70,000 in a garage, and they cut the whole back of the garage off and went in the garage and got the ones out. So they was just, you know, it was just a problem. And I didn't want to be having no $30,000 worth of ones every single day.
Sure.
You know?
So a lot of people are probably thinking, if you're making $1 million a day, why the hell did you not just quit while you were ahead?
Well, you know, it got so easy that it's hard to quit.
Yeah.
You know, you're not really doing anything, but telling other people what to do. And, it was too easy, you know. And I was thinking, like, they can't catch me unless they find me with some drugs. I wasn't hip to conspiracy, to the conspiracy laws. I wasn't even aware when they did the change the crack law. You know, we didn't watch the news. You know, we didn't pay attention to what was going on in Washington, D.C. and all that stuff. It was like that stuff had no relevance to me, you know.
How'd you stay ahead of the cops the whole time? I mean, you must have, because somebody must have been calling them, or there must have been some informants. There must have been some rivals. How'd you stay ahead of the cops?
Well, you know, when I sit in prison and I analyze the cops, you know, thankful that they turn out to be corrupt and crooked. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I'd be doing the rest of my life in prison right now. But they were lazy, too. You know, not only was they corrupt and crooked and steal and lie and write fake search warrants, but they were lazy, too. They didn't want to do their job. All they wanted was the money. I mean, they was just like us.
Yeah.
You know, they was drug dealers, really.
Interesting.
They had flipped. You know, they had went from when they went in and swore to protect and to serve to, we're going to serve ourselves. You know, we're going to get this money.
So they would come after you and you would just give them, you would just tip them off or what? How did that work?
Oh, no, not like that. They wasn't corrupt like they was on the payroll or nothing like that. No, what they were doing was they would catch you, break in your house with the batarang, come in and steal all your money and take you to jail. And then lie about how they did it. You know, like the search warrant might not be a good search warrant. They might have didn't go and get the judge to sign it. They might have just signed the judge's name on there. And then they would take you to court and put you in prison on lies. You know, in my case, they said that they saw me carrying a bag with drugs in it. And I threw the bag and it was a lie. I didn't have drugs. You know, I didn't even carry drugs at that time myself. And it was interesting when we went to court, the judge had kind of like scolded him about how brilliant they said I was. You know, I was so brilliant. I put together this great organization, and then they turn right back around and tell the judge I was carrying the bag with the drugs and the pistol. And the judge was like, hold up. This same guy that you saying had all these guys working for him, and he's walking with 30 or 40 guys and nobody has drugs but him.
Right. Yeah.
And then the judge told him, well, keep going. I hear some more. And then the guy tried to explain to the judge that I went crazy and lost my mind.
Right. But you were still able to run this big organization.
Right.
Even though you were crazy and lost your mind.
Correct.
And were totally careless.
Exactly.
So he didn't buy that, or she didn't buy that.
Well, he didn't throw it out then. What had happened is I was in jail mm-hmm. at the time, and I had turned myself in to the judge because I didn't want to have any contact with the police. Because they had told people they were going to kill me. So when I did that, the cops wasn't supposed to come and see me. And they came down to the county jail without telling my lawyer, without asking the judge, and took me back in a little room.
And then what?
Well, when the judge found out about it, he was like furious, you know, that they did that. And he wanted the tape to where they had been talking to me and interviewing me. And the cops had incriminated themselves on the tape. So what they did is they cut the stuff out of the tape.
So they edited the tape.
They edited the tape. But
you could tell when that happens because it just goes blip. Yeah.
Yeah. So we had an expert to come in, and he told the judge that it had been edited and so forth. And the judge let me out of jail immediately.
Sure. Yeah. Wow. That's very corrupt to see that they edited the tape. That's, I remember in law school, it was called Fruit of the Poisonous Tree. You can't use that in court.
Oh, you went to law school?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Okay. I did too.
Did you?
Yeah, in jail.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say, you probably know a lot more about this stuff than I do. That's for sure. I want to talk about the prison stuff in a little bit here, but I'm wondering, do you ever think like, wow, what I was doing really screwed up the area where I grew up?
Oh, absolutely. I see the devastation right now. Basically, it uprooted the black community. Because we used to own South Central LA, and now we're homeless in South Central LA. Mm-hmm. I see the cardboard boxes with so many of us living in them. And I know that I played a big part in helping that take place. Not intentionally, but it eventually happened.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, I'm coming up with ways to help reverse, you know, what I did. While I was in prison, I studied hard. I read over 300 books, taught myself how to read and write.
How did you teach yourself how to read and write in prison?
With cue cards.
Like flashcards? You're showing yourself the letter?
ABCs. Taught myself the ABCs, me and my cellie. My cellie is my roommate.
You know? Oh, okay.
You're in a bunk bed, so you have a guy on the bottom, a guy on the top. And me and him sit down, and he showed me how to sound out my words. In a couple of weeks, I was reading. Start off reading the newspaper, then I'm reading law books, my indictment.
You started to read your indictment?
Yeah.
That's a big step from ABC, singing your ABCs, to being like, let me read this indictment.
Well, you know, the indictment was probably the first time that I ever wanted to know what was on a piece of paper.
Oh, yeah. You probably desperately wanted to know what was written in there, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, the lawyer handed it to him, and he was like, oh, here, this will tell you everything you want to know about what's going on with your case.
And you're like, oh, man.
Yeah, I want to know what that says. So, yeah. So I go in, I tell my cellie, I was like, man, you got to read my indictment to me. And he was like, huh, stop it. Read your own indictment. And, you know, I had to convince him that I couldn't read. And then he convinced me that I could. And that's how it started.
Huh. So you study this and you start to read the indictment. Yeah. So you learn how to read and you said in a few weeks. Did you ever think, man, if I'd spent this few weeks over one summer, I could have gone to college and played tennis?
Absolutely. Not just that, you know, with my mind and my work ethic, there's no telling what I could have did. Because, you know, when I look back at my life, I know that I've never failed. You know, everything that I've ever went after, I always accomplished it. Even with going to prison, you know, I knew I was going to prison.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I used to sell drugs, I knew that I was going to be going to
eventually
prison.
Eventually, you thought, I'm going to get caught at some point.
Yeah, I'm going to prison, you know. I used to ask my girlfriends, you know, like, what you going to do when I go to prison? You going to come see me? You going to visit me? You going to send me packages? And, you know, because, you know, I'd heard the stories about what you need when you're in jail. So I want to know, you know, hey, you living a high life right here with me. They're not going to get you, though.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you're not selling drugs.
Right.
But you live like a drug dealer. You know, you're getting all the benefits, all the perks. And so when I sit back in prison and I started writing my book, I was knowing that in order for me to ask her that question, I knew I was going to prison.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. And did you think, how did you plan for that? Did you, because I would imagine there's no shoebox with 85 grand buried in your mom's backyard.
No, I never planned. You know what everybody told me when I was coming up was to buy real estate.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I did. I bought real estate. I had money when I went to prison. I had a little money still when I went to prison, but property wasn't being managed by the proper people, and my family just didn't have the background to hold together an enterprise. You know, they had never been schooled and they didn't have the desire. You know, it was my dream to be wealthy. It wasn't necessarily their dreams, and it could have been a wish for them to be wealthy, you know, because it's a difference between a wish and a burning desire. You know, a wish is something that people do. Most people do, you know, oh, I wish I could do this, but they never take the steps to accomplish that. And what I found out is that I don't have a problem taking those steps, you know, even if it's not perfect, if I'm not really ready to take those steps, I'll still go out on a limb and take a chance when most people won't.
You said in I think this is in the documentary, the drugs become a crutch for the dealer as much as for the user. What does that mean?
Well, anytime something goes wrong, you want to sell drugs, you know, mm-hmm. Selling drugs and make it better. Rent due? Oh, I just go out and sell drugs and get the rent. I need a car? I just go sell drugs and get the car. I need to help my family? I just go sell drugs. Because America is kind of a hypocrite.
What do you mean?
Well, we say we don't like drug dealers on the surface. You know, nobody likes drug dealers on the surface.
Right. But then the most popular rap artist is Tupac, Biggie. I don't even know who else now. My rap education stopped in 1998.
How many people you go in their house and the picture they got on the wall, Scarface?
Oh, yeah. Sure.
You know, you can go in almost anybody's house and they got a picture of Scarface on the wall. I mean, who don't like Scarface? Who didn't watch it? So that tells you right there that there is a love for that lifestyle, and they promote that lifestyle, but then they punish the people who who really get involved, and they look at them differently. I mean, even if you turn on the radio right now, every song that comes on got something about drugs in it, you know, selling drugs, being a drug dealer, wanting to be a drug dealer. So in actuality, this is a message that's telling a normal person or a kid or somebody whose understanding is not totally solid. I mean, even some people who are, because these cops, you know, probably went to college and was college educated, sure, and they fell into the drug, even though they didn't. And some of them did actually sell drugs, so they would take drugs and plant them on different people. So they were still using the drugs as a tool, because I only used cocaine as a tool.
A means to an end, yeah.
A means to an end, yes. So it wasn't like I went out and I invented cocaine or I was trying to destroy my neighborhood. It was just there. It was a tool, and I used it.
So you could have sold CDs, and you would have had – I mean, it wouldn't have been as easy to sell CDs for sure, but you could have done
anything. Maybe easier.
Who knows?
It could have been easier.
Probably not $2 million a day worth of CDs, though. Who know? But who knows? I don't know. You get a
Sam Walton did it.
That's true.
With Walmart. Yeah, touche. I mean, you know, Nike. Yeah. Nike did it with Phil Knight is doing it with Nike.
That's right.
You know, Bill Gates is doing it with, you know, with Microsoft. I mean, there's. I read all these books because I wanted to know the similarities to business. You know, I didn't understand business. Nobody ever taught me business. My mom didn't know business. I didn't have any uncles that knew business, so. Everything that I learned from the streets. So I wanted to know what was the difference between real business and the cocaine business.
And what did you find?
There's none. They're both almost identical. You know, if you do the same things, and legitimate business may be easier in some ways, because if you ever told Bill Gates that he would be going to prison if he kept Microsoft open, he'd shut the doors tomorrow. He'd walk away. I knew I was going to prison. I knew that somebody could kill me every day that I got up. You know, I was like, Rick, why would you get up and put on a bulletproof vest in the morning? Why was you carrying a pistol? Because I knew that somebody might be wanting to take my drugs and they would be willing to kill me. And I had made a decision that if somebody tried to kill me, that I would kill them. So I was willing to put everything on the line, which I found out later on in life that there are certain things that we should never put on the line. And then after I got even deeper, I looked at it like I was putting my whole family on the line. Mm-hmm. You know, my little brothers, when I brought them in, when I got them off of drugs and brought them into my organization, they carry guns. And they were willing to pretty much do whatever was necessary to keep it functioning.
There's a lot of in the story that I feel like you can't make this stuff up. You got your drugs from Nicaragua. The CIA was moving the drugs to you. Tell us about that whole connection. Because when I saw that, I was like, wait a minute, what?
Well, you know, I didn't know anything about the CIA. Like I said, I didn't even know Danilo was from Nicaragua.
Yeah.
When I...
Your connection, Danilo Blandón, you didn't even know.
Nah, I just, when I first started, I thought he was Spanish, you know.
Sure.
You know, he looks like a Mexican. I thought he was Mexican.
Sure.
And then later on, I started to find out that they were from a country called Nicaragua, and they were involved in a war, you know. Mm-hmm. Okay, fine. I understand. I'm in a war, too.
Yeah.
I'm in a war here in South Central L.A. You know, we warned. The police still making us sit on the ground, hitting us in the head with flashlights. So we at war, too. I can go along with that. So it wasn't until sitting in courtroom that all this stuff started to, like, come to light. And my lawyer was contacted by this reporter named Gary Webb. He wrote a book called Dark Alliance, too, that I'm one of the featured characters. And Gary was telling us that it was more to the story than we knew. And I felt, oh, yeah, well, maybe more corrupt cops.
Sure, yeah.
Great news. Yeah. So I'm thinking that this is going to be a continuation. Well, anyway, Gary published a story called Dark Alliance in the San Jose Mercury News. And the next day, it's like Bill Clinton did an article and my name is in the article. I'm like, the president of the United States mentioned your name and the CIA director mentions your name. And in that article, Gary talked about the gang CIA connection, saying that he had made a link between the CIA and the gangs of South Central LA.
This is an investigative reporter. Yeah. He's pretty got a pretty good reputation.
A great reputation. Yeah. A Pulitzer Prize winning reporter. An all-around good guy.
Yeah, he won the Pulitzer Prize for, was it for this story?
Was it this one? I don't know.
I don't know either. I got to check.
Well, you know, a lot of the stuff, you know, he got crucified for writing this story.
Oh, yeah.
But later on, they found out that a lot of the things that he had said in the paper were accurate. You know, people tried to twist the story all kind of ways. You know, people came to me and were saying stuff like, oh, so you think the CIA deliberately put cocaine in the black community? And I was like, I never said that. Yeah. Gary never said that, but it was just different things that they were trying to attack him on, you know. And I believe what he said is that the CIA didn't care where they got the money from. They just needed the money to fight the war. If it came from the black community, the white community, they didn't care. They just wanted the money. But we also know at the same time that the people in the White House really don't care about the black community. You know, they don't really care what happens over there. So if the undesirables get a hold of cocaine and it affects their community, so be it. And that's why so many young black men are locked up right now today for selling drugs.
There's an interesting, I don't know if it's irony, you're illiterate until, how old were you when you went to prison? 28?
28,
okay.
Yeah.
And then you learn to read with the flashcards, you learn to read some books, you read your indictment. That's kind of what got you out of prison, though.
It is, absolutely.
How did that happen?
Well, you know, I started studying the law the way I sold drugs. You know, I sold drugs all day, all night. That became my passion, you know. When other people would be at football games and watching basketball and football on TV, I would be out on the block selling drugs. So in jail, when they would be watching football and basketball, I would be sitting in my cell reading over my indictment, law books. Even when I couldn't have the law books in my cell, I would make copies for the weekend of case laws so that I could sit there and study the case law. One of the things a guy told me is that nobody should know more about my case than I knew about my case. And I wanted to make that a point. So one day I was just reading a book and then it just like popped out and it was like continuous criminal spree is different than a career criminal. You know, a continuous criminal spree is a person that's and basically the way I explained it to my lawyer is, say, for instance, if a guy, say his son needed an operation and he needs $100,000. Mm-hmm. And he wakes up one morning and he knows that this block makes $100,000 in one day. And he says, you know what? I'm going to go invest $300 today and I'm going to make that $100,000 today. Well, say the cops come up and they're observing him and they see him make 100 sales. He's not a career criminal.
He just had one continuous criminal spree.
Exactly. So, and it don't matter what city you in, what state you in, it's still a continuous criminal spree because you could jump on a plane in one day and be in Arizona, you can make a sale in Arizona, and you get on another plane and be in Cincinnati, make another sale. So I had to explain to them that, because they thought in my case where it was different was because mine was different states. You know, my convictions came from different states.
So that changed your sentencing guidelines.
Correct.
Oh, interesting.
So I still got sentenced, but it wasn't the life sentence without the possibility of parole because it was a continuous criminal spree and not three strikes.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's interesting. You read a lot in prison other than your indictment. Did anything stick out? Like, what books would you recommend that you picked up in prison?
Well, my favorite books and the books that I build my principles on. And one of the reasons I did is because I saw myself in all these books. My favorite three books is The Richest Man in Babylon by George Clasey, Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill, and As a Man Think by James Allen. Those books like really like open my eyes and really showed me who I am and what I could be. I'm unstoppable because I don't have any, you know, what are strings attached to me. You know, I don't allow people to be able to control me. Mm-hmm. Per se, you know, have things that I want or that I desire. I don't really desire anything. It's like I'm in a state of almost being surreal. You know, it's like I just love the position that I'm in, you know, like I'm just like overjoyed. And probably because, you know, I'm going to prison and losing my life. You know, most people don't get to lose their life and then get it back.
Right. Yeah, that's true. You came out of the abyss.
Yeah. So now it's like, when I was in jail, you know, you get to spend $300 a month. You only go to the store once a week. You know, you have to watch on TV what everybody else watches. You couldn't go to the library when you want to. So now to be out in the world and to be able to pretty much do whatever I want to do and nobody can say nothing to me, it's like almost like unreal.
What was the first thing you did when you got out of jail? Were you like, I got to get to Taco Bell? Or were you like, I miss my mom's cooking? Like, what was the first thing?
No. We get, you can eat anything you want in jail if you got a little money. And I had money in jail. I ran a store. I was the lender.
Of course, you had a business in jail. Why would you not have
Absolutely.
A business in jail?
I did credit repair over the telephone.
Really?
Through the mail. Yeah. I was doing credit repair. So I had money in jail. You know, I was getting about $800 a month. From the street, not from my family.
So if you're at home and you're thinking, I don't know how to start my own business, just remember that there was a guy in prison earning $800 a month from jail with no cell phone, no internet.
Oh, when I used to say, when they give me a three-way phone, oh, it's on and popping. I'm going to kill them with a three-way phone. That's all I needed was a three-way phone, because one of my problems I used to have, because I was doing music from jail too. You know, I was in the cell with Harry O when they started Death Row Records, so I was kind of like, man, Harry O did that from jail. So I wanted to start me a record label. So one of the things I used to say is, they give me a three-way phone.
What's a three-way phone? What is
that? A three-way phone call. You know, you can put two people on the phone. Because, you know, in jail, what I would do is I would call people and they would say, oh, yeah, I'll take care of that. And then when you call them back, man, I couldn't catch that cat. You know, he didn't answer his phone. So if they don't answer the phone, they don't get together, I can't get my commission.
Right.
So I'll be saying, man, and in jail, if somebody puts you on a three-way, and then you lose your phone privileges because they can't hear one of the conversations. So the jail doesn't like us to make three-way phone calls.
Got it.
So I just said, man, all I need is a three-way phone call. And in there, you only get 300 minutes a month, too. So it was kind of handicapping, but, I made it work.
Started a business. Yeah. So that's you're still able to make that work even with those limitations, because there are people right now that have internet, smartphone. Their parents are paying for their rent, or they live with friends or something. They're like, I just can't make it happen. I can't make it happen.
Well, you know, most people want everything to be perfect, you know, and I've learned that you have to start with nothing. You know, like with my T-shirt business, I started with $300. You know, I bought
a kilo of T-shirts, unfortunately, does not go for the same rate.
No, but you know, I didn't get a kilo on my first cocaine. That's you know, right. My first cocaine, I started with 3 grams, and part of that was McKnight.
Yeah. Well, we'll link to those books, by the way, in the show notes. Rarely do we get a chance to talk to somebody who had the time to read all day, every day for years on end. So those are pretty good recommendations, I would imagine.
No doubt. Y'all better get those books, especially if you're having financial problems or you're not enjoying life. Those books are like medicine.
What do you think about the 20 years lost as a result of selling drugs? You know, if you had to do it all over again, what would you, I assume you wouldn't sell drugs, but I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Well, you know what? People ask me, how do I feel about it?
Do you regret it and all that stuff?
Yeah. And you know what? It's no regrets, only lessons, you know, cause I learned from all of that. I mean, the time that I spent in prison, I wouldn't give it back if I could, you know, at that time. I mean, everybody don't get to go to prison. You know, it's an experience maybe fortunate not, you know, because I learned a lot from being in prison. You know, I learned a lot about people. I learned a lot about myself. It was another experience, you know, that people are not going to get to do. You know, like everybody can't go to the moon. So the people who go to the moon, you can say, oh, he was trapped in a little tiny shell for however many months, you know, but. How did he feel about that? You know, it's all about how you look at it. You know, Senator John McCain, who just passed, I read a book on him when he was a POW and how he looked at it. He looked at it as if when he was a POW, he was there for his whole country. So it wasn't about just him. When I was in prison, I was there for my family, you know, so that my family can do better. So it wasn't just about me. So I felt that I could sacrifice myself so that my family could have a better life. I was willing to do that.
Are you ever tempted to go back because of the insane amounts of money that
cocaine?
Not to prison, to cocaine? Yeah.
No money in cocaine.
No. Too
money,
saturated now?
More money in marijuana.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. There's probably more money in weed now, for sure. So the legacy that you want to leave behind, what do you want to do? What do you want to do now that you're out, that you're that you're done, you're clean out of that whole thing?
Well, one of the things that I'm really working on right now, I'm starting a millionaires club where I plan on teaching 250 people how to become millionaires. And just basically teach people how to be entrepreneurs, you know, that you don't have to sit around and wait on a rich uncle, rich auntie to come along or LeBron James to come up and give you some money, that you can get out and start on your own. You can start with nothing. You know, when I got out of prison, I only had a few dollars to start with. And I came home to some burdens. You know, my mom was losing her house when I got home, and it wasn't easy to know that, you know, your mom is going to be homeless.
Yeah.
You know, I was there when the marshals knocked on the door and told us that we had, you know, a couple hours to get all of her stuff out the house. So,
oh, wow.
To have to deal with that fresh out of prison is not easy. But, you know, who said life was supposed to be easy?
Thank you so much, man. Is there anything I haven't asked you that you want to make sure that you get on record?
No, you did pretty good. Be on the lookout. We're going to be shooting our movie. My movie in probably January, February. Make sure you get the book.
Yeah, we'll link to that in the show notes too.
Yeah, I need the book. I'm trying to hit 100,000 copies. You know, I self-published my book.
Yeah, you get a bigger cut that way.
Yes.
Yeah.
But that's about it. You know, I'm just out here pushing, man, trying to make the world a better place.
This episode was a lot of fun. His team was so professional. His story was so interesting. And he really was just not trying to front at all. He really just told it like it was. I really enjoyed this interview. Great big thank you to Freeway Ricky Ross. We'll link to his website and resources in the show notes as well. And if you want to know how I managed to book all these great people and manage my relationships with show guests and other entrepreneurs and other business owners, I use systems and tiny habits. I don't procrastinate. I do it now because I know I need to dig the well before I get thirsty. Once you need relationships, you are way too late. One of the reasons the Jordan Harbinger Show kicked off so quickly is because of my relationships. It is the primary reason, in fact, and I want to teach you how I do that for free. I've got a course called Level One. Again, not one of those like enter your credit card. I don't do that. Go to advancedhumandynamics.com/level1 and check it out. These drills are designed to take just a few minutes a day. It's the stuff I wish I knew a decade ago. It is not fluff. And you can find it at advancedhumandynamics.com/level1. And speaking of building relationships, tell me your number one takeaway from Freeway Ricky Ross. I'm at Jordan Harbinger on both Twitter and Instagram. This show is produced in association with Podcast One, and this episode was co-produced by Jason Underpass DeFilippo and Jen Harbinger. Show notes are by Robert Fogarty. Worksheets by Caleb Bacon, and I'm your host, Jordan Harbinger. The fee for this show is that you share it with friends when you find something useful, which is hopefully in every single episode. So please do share the show with those you love and even those you don't. Lots more in the pipeline. Very excited to bring it to you. And in the meantime, do your best to apply what you hear on the show so you can live what you listen. And we'll see you next time.